This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from the August 2026 issue of Arizona Highways. Going to start out today with the article by Amali Rebeck entitled Empire Ranch. It's not the oldest homestead in Arizona. That distinction goes to Walpi on the Hopi tribe's land, but Empire Ranch in southern Arizona is high on the list. This month, the historic property, established by a couple of kids in their early 20s, turns 150. In the grasslands near Sonoyta, a windmill rises from the desert landscape, marking the entrance to the historic Empire Ranch. Beyond it, old corrals, wooden barns, and single-level houses rest against the southern Arizona horizon. And inside the main house, historical furnishings and artifacts offer glimpses into the ranch's nuanced past. Located in La Cienega's National Conservation Area, the ranch has stood for 150 years and remains open to the public year-round thanks to volunteers with the Empire Ranch Foundation, which helps to maintain the site's historic buildings and surrounding landscape. Since its founding in 1997, the ERF has worked not only to maintain the ranch, but also to piece together its history. Via donations and historical archives, volunteers have collected letters, photographs, and records that define what everyday life on the Empire Ranch was like, from cattle drives and homesteading to the backgrounds of the people who lived and worked there. The volunteers collected a lot from families who donated items, says Kimberly Patterson, the ERF's administrator. We did interviews with all of the family members and cowboys who worked here and the people who lived in the area, so all of it is pretty well documented. The ranch began as an adobe homestead with a modest four-room house and a corral. But after it was purchased by Walter L. Vail and Herbert Hislop in 1876, it became one of the largest and most influential cattle ranches in present-day Arizona, with more than 100,000 acres stretching from the Rincon Mountains to the Mexican border. Vail and Hislop were 23 and 24 years old, and they came and wanted to be cattle ranchers because they were trying to figure out how to make money, and everyone said, "Go west, young man," and they did, Patterson says. They came and bought the ranch and then immediately started buying up other pieces of property. The discovery of silver deposits further fueled the ranch's growth, with the new Total Wreck mine bringing in revenue that helped fund expansion across the property. But in 1928, the Vail sold the ranch to the Boyce family, who continued cattle operations and upgraded the living quarters of the home, remodeling the kitchen, dining room, and living room, and even adding a swimming pool. After the Boyce family sold the land in the late 1960s to the Gulf American Land Corporation, plans emerged for a large residential community to replace the ranch, an idea that didn't sit well with area residents and others with memories there. When they tried to turn it into a subdivision with a bowling alley and a golf course, luckily there was enough pushback, Patterson says. Instead, the ranch house was listed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1976, and eventually the land was acquired by the Federal Bureau of Land Management. And today, the house is maintained by the ERF in coordination with the Bureau. But preserving the ranch's collection of buildings, barns, and corrals, and even its windmill, is an ongoing challenge due to the overwhelming maintenance needs. Rick Collins, vice president of the ERF, says demolition by neglect is the foundation's biggest enemy. Buildings want to fall back into the ground, especially adobe buildings, because they want to become dirt again, he says. It's always an uphill battle because we have a lot of buildings, so which comes first on the list? In the meantime, volunteers such as Collins and Patterson use preserved rooms in the ranch house and barns to display artifacts that include wagon repair tools and a telegraph in Vail's original office. Currently, they're working to expand the site's exhibits and add a film display that highlights the movies shot on the ranch, from the 1976 version of A Star is Born to the popular John Wayne westerns Red River and the Cowboys. Volunteers also lead field trip tours and ensure that the property is kept up for visitors, especially those looking to explore the ranch's nearby walking trails. On August 22nd, the foundation will celebrate the ranch's 150th anniversary with walkthroughs of the house, docent readings of diary excerpts from former residents, and interactive exhibits. But the anniversary is more than a milestone celebration. It's also a reminder that landmarks such as the Empire Ranch survive only because of the people willing to care for them. Empire Ranch is located near Sonida. For more information, contact the Empire Ranch Foundation at 888-364-2829, website empireranchfoundation.org. And this concludes Empire Ranch. This month, August in history, cloudburst caused extensive damage around Arizona on August 7, 1930. Two people died when a Santa Fe Railway passenger train went over a collapsed trestle near Winslow, and four more were killed by a wall of water that flooded streets and homes in Nogales. A stock company was organized in Los Angeles on August 13, 1915, to search for the buried treasure said to be hidden at Mission San Jose de Tumacacori, part of Tumacacori National Historical Park. As with most such treasure hunts, the effort proved fruitless. Mormon missionary and explorer Jacob Hamblin, who played a major role in settling parts of northern Arizona, died in New Mexico Territory on August 31, 1886. Kelly Vaughn is the author of The Copper Note. When Michelle and Stephen Sullins first laid eyes on an airy, light-filled space on the top floor of the historic Burmeister building, they just knew. The minute we saw this location, we instantly saw success and said, "This space speaks of an upscale, fine dining room," Michelle says. "Prescott really doesn't have many high-end restaurants, and we knew that the market would respond well to it." And it has. Since the Copper Note, named for Arizona's copper industry, but also for the notes of food, wine, and spirits that are increasingly making Prescott a dining destination, opened in October 2025, it's attracted tourists and locals alike. They come for the decadent but healthful fare and return time and again for the exceptional service and views of Courthouse Square. Michelle says the menu items that most resonate with customers are a New England clam chowder topped with shrimp, southwestern corn relish, and fresh cilantro, the voodoo pasta, which features homemade Italian sausage, chicken, mushrooms, and diced tomatoes tossed in Alfredo and marinara sauces and served over a bed of rigatoni, and the ahi tuna poke, sashimi-grade ahi seared with black and white sesame seeds topped with a soy glaze and fennel garnish, and served over quinoa basmatic rice pilaf and green beans almondine. "We call it an a la minute menu," Michelle says. "Everything is made from scratch and made to order. The menu is inspired by fresh and well-caught fish, hand-cut steaks, fresh products, and some unique dishes. We're pretty health-conscious, so we use the highest quality products, and I think that shows in the presentation and freshness. Robust desserts such as a chocolate flourless cake and a New York-style cheesecake and an extensive bar menu and wine list round out the Copper Note's offerings. And Michelle and Stephen are no strangers to running a successful restaurant. After meeting in 2009, they launched Sedona's Sound Bites Grill, a popular venture they helmed until they sold it in 2021. A few years later, a friend introduced them to the space in the Burmeister building. The rest, as they say, is history. Now, on weekends, the Sullinses and their team offer brunch, complete with a live performance by a jazz trio on Sundays. And Wednesdays through Sundays, the restaurant's bar is full service, just in case all the tables are occupied. "We really hope to cultivate an upscale environment," Michelle says. "We train our employees hard, our service is well received, and our customers are supportive. We hope to become Prescott's premier dining spot." The Copper Note is located at 120 West Gurley Street in Prescott, phone number 928-515-3359, website thecoppernote.com. And this concludes The Copper Note. Jackie Elpers is the author of Desert Mountain Didgeridoos. The first didgeridoos, among the oldest instruments in the world, were developed by Aboriginal tribes in Australia more than 1,000 years ago. They can be made out of any hollow tube, even PVC pipe. Down in Tucson, Kyle Burt uses agave stalks to create instruments he refers to as old souls. Kyle Burt breathes new life into the hollowed stalks of departed agave flowers, literally. When agave reaches the end of its life, it spends its last gasp growing an asparagus-like stalk with flowering branches that can reach 50 feet into the air. And after dropping the seeds that become its children, the dead agave stands in wait for years in the Sonoran Desert, dotting the sky with a signature skeleton. For a few special of these stalks, that's where Bert, an artist and the owner of Desert Mountain Didgeridoos, comes in. Over the past 25 years, he's used agave stalks to create more than 700 didgeridoos. The didgeridoo is one of the oldest musical instruments in the world, developed by Aboriginal tribes in Australia more than 1,000 years ago. Originally made from a whole tree branch hollowed by termites, didgeridoos can be crafted out of any hollow tube, even a PVC pipe. The instruments produce deep, resonant vibrations that amplify the voice of the musician, whether they're buzzing their lips, singing, shouting, or growling like a wild beast. Agave stalks make an ideal base for a didgeridoo, particularly when they've been maturing in the desert for 5 years or longer. Bert calls the instruments produced from these stalks the old souls. Their sound is deeper and denser, with a character shaped by pecking birds, burrowing insects, wind, dust, heat, and rain. Older stalks also develop intense red and pink pigmentation from their time baking in the sun, and a select few become infected with a white fungus that further modulates their color and texture, a process similar to that of highly prized blotted wood. Agave stalks have a hardwood shell filled with soft pulp. After cutting the stalk to size, Bert bores from both ends using drill extensions fitted with a wire brush and drum sanding attachments that shred the pulp from the inside without damaging the hard exterior. He then carves a mouthpiece out of resonant tone woods, taking into consideration the wood's visual and acoustic compatibility with the stalk. The mouthpiece is permanently attached to the hollow stalk with the resin that amplifies the resonance. Surface cracks and holes are sanded down, and some are filled with crushed local turquoise mixed with resin. Bert sometimes collaborates with friends who paint and woodburn the instruments, adding their own artistic vision. After a final coat of resin, the instrument is complete. Every didgeridoo is unique, and the sound of each is a surprise, which is why one of Bert's greatest joys is playing the newly constructed instrument. He cherishes the anticipation so much that he puts off playing it for the first time to let the excitement build. That relationship is therapeutic, too. The first time he ever played a didge, he says, he felt a lifetime of anxiety begin to dissipate, and he's not alone. Many didgeridoo players associate a personal transformation, whether spiritual, psychological, or physical, with picking up the instrument. That's partly because playing the didgeridoo requires extensive breath control. A continuous drone sound is sustained through a technique called circular breathing, in which air stored in the cheeks is expelled while the player breathes in through the nose. The didgeridoo catches that breath and turns it into frequencies that are at and below the lower threshold of human hearing, but can be felt in the listener's chest and abdomen. Not surprisingly, studies have shown myriad wellness benefits from playing the didgeridoo, including better lung capacity, better overall health, and reduced anxiety. And a 2005 study in the British Medical Journal found that playing a didgeridoo helps reduce snoring and sleep apnea by strengthening airway muscles. Whether Desert Mountain Didgeridoo's customers see health benefits or not, Bert says he hopes his handcrafted instruments bring people the same joy, self-expression, and connection that they bring him, while allowing them to carry a piece of the desert wherever they go. Desert Mountain Didgeridoo's is located in Tucson. Phone number 406-580-1798. Website desertmountaindidges.com. And this concludes Desert Mountain Didgeridoos. Shane McDermott is the author of This Is My Story. The picture attached to the story is a 12-shot stitch panoramic image of the wave in North Coyote Buttes near the Arizona state line with Utah. Shane captured the image during a photo workshop last August during the summer monsoon. It's extremely difficult to obtain a permit for this location, as the Bureau of Land Management allows only 60 people per day to access the landscape via a lottery system. Many thousands of people apply each month, so the odds of winning the lottery are less than 5%. All of the guides at my company, Action Photo Tours, apply each month, and among all of us, we're usually lucky enough to win one lottery each year. Last year, I won the lottery, so we organized a photo tour around this location. We went in early in the day, hoping the monsoon storms would provide us with some nice cloud drama. We weren't disappointed. At about 1 p.m., the skies let loose with a massive storm of rain, hail, and lightning. All the other groups in the area were scrambling out as quickly as they could, but it's a 4-mile hike back to the trailhead, so I knew we wouldn't outrun the storm. We took cover in a large alcove and waited it out, which took about 2 hours. By then, everyone was pretty anxious to get out of there and back to the vehicles. However, I insisted we first revisit the wave because I knew it would be filled with water from the downpour we'd just experienced. Fortunately, we had the place to ourselves until sunset. I've always wanted to see the wave filled with water. It was amazingly beautiful and magical. And this concludes This Is My Story. Next is an essay by Tyler Williams. Mother Nature had a heyday in Arizona. Grand Canyon, Monument Valley, the Chiricahuas. She also drew a line that runs across the top half of the state. Raindrops falling to the northeast of that line flow into the Little Colorado River on the southwest side of the line. All water goes toward the Gila River. This headwater ridgeline is called the Arizona Divide. There is a lone bristlecone pine that grows above timberline on a slope of cinders. In winter, the tree emerges and hides with the passing of storm fogs, appearing like a mirage out of the white. My ski partner and I call it the Spirit Tree. When the snow melts beneath this tree in May or June, water seeps and creeps and ping-pongs its way down the mountainside, not on the surface, but just below the loose little lava pebbles. In a meadow below, the subterranean water is squeezed upward, where it nurtures a grove of gnarled old blue spruce. From that spruce grove, the water makes a decision, right or left. A right turn will take it south to the Gila River, then into the Colorado River near Yuma. Left flowing water will wend its way north to the Little Colorado River, west through the Grand Canyon, and then south also to Yuma. There, where the waters of the Colorado and the Gila meet, the snowmelt from the Spirit Tree is reunited. Both journeys cover more than 500 miles, and the splitting of the waters occurs not just at the old spruce trees on the flanks of the San Francisco peaks, but continuously along a dividing ridge that runs across Arizona and into New Mexico. Raindrops falling to the northeast of the ridge flow into the Little Colorado. On the southwest side, all water goes toward the Gila. This headwater ridgeline is called the Arizona Divide. The world is made of divides. Some we've all heard of. The Continental Divide, the Pacific Crest. But spurring off of those noble heights are other tentacles of ridge that separate our waterways every which way, but always downhill. Water is mandated to flow with gravity, no matter what direction that might lead. The Arizona Divide splits our two main watersheds, the Little Colorado and the Gila, in opposite directions. Still, nearly all of that water ends up, if given the opportunity, in the Colorado River. These thoughts wobble through my brain as I stand atop the Mogollon Rim looking south, surveying wave after craggy wave of blue horizon, each creating a sub-basin of its own, all bound for the Gila. Spinning north, I see the atmosphere is purple, reflecting the colorful tones of the Painter Desert. From my vantage high in the rim, it's easy to see the land tilting toward that glow, toward the Little Colorado. I'm snapped out of my reverie by a crack of thunder. I'm on an exposed ridge. It's time to go. Gazing across vast landscapes brings glorious moments such as this while traveling the divide, but the spaces between are what I find most rewarding. Crossing a pass covered in shoulder-high ferns, discovering a giant aspen, finding a perfect campsite beneath arching oaks. Exploring the divide is a high country romp down elk trails and dusty roads. I walk, I drive, I ride. Pedaling my fat, tired e-bike, I found, is the most practical means of travel along the divide, equally comfortable on gravel roads and rutted two-tracks. It's not a novel concept. Search for Arizona Divide and you're likely to find the Divide Ride, a bicycle route that follows it for nearly 300 miles. Best time, 2 days, 14 hours. The cyclists, of course, aren't tracing every inch of the divide to each summit, cone, or rocky rim. They're staying near it on rideable roads. To trace the very crest requires hiking, often an easy stroll, but sometimes they scramble up bluffs, over deadfall, and through piney locust bushes. Still, routes exist near the divide for much of its length. Interstate 40 crosses it west of Flagstaff. There is a sign. Interstate 17 crests the divide too at the exit for Fort Tuthill County Park south of town. If you attend a concert at the amphitheater there, you'll be standing on the Gila side of things, amble over to the rodeo arena, and you're in Little Colorado territory. State Route 87 crosses the divide imperceptibly along the flat spine of Blue Ridge near Clint's Well. East of Payson on State Route 260, the divide is more obvious as the pavement finally surmounts the dramatic Mogollon Rim and enters a cathedral of yellow pines. To follow the divide in either direction from my vantage point, one can follow Forest Road 300, which has been a route for a long time, from game trail to foot trail to horse path to gravel byway. There aren't really many options. The rim falls away in cliffs to the south and a long string of forested draws slash the landscape to the north. The rim's edge is the only place to go. The rim and the divide are one and the same here, but the divide doesn't always stay on that precipitous edge. South of Flagstaff, the colorful rim bursts from plateaus of somber pines, but the divide sits quietly behind the scenes, higher and miles back from the cliff edge. Modest old volcanoes claim the high points, and the divide traces a winding path from one to the next, Woody Mountain, Mormon Mountain, Hutch Mountain. From the summit of Hutch, I look out across windswept grasslands and wide mesas, Colorado Plateau country, and down into the deep, cactus-draped valleys of the Sonoran Desert. It seems as if I'm straddling two worlds, and I am. The boundary between the Colorado Plateau and the Basin and Range Province provides the backbone for the divide, but that border is often muted as solidified lava flows cover the underlying skeleton of the Earth's surface. In the forests around Hutch Mountain, for example, the divide is tricky to follow. It might exist amid an indiscernibly flat meadow as much as it might follow a defined ridge or a sheer cliff edge. That all changes near Baker Butte on the very corner of the Colorado Plateau. Here, the Mogollon Rim emerges in full force, and instead of traveling north-south, the rim and the divide turn abruptly to the east. There is no doubt where the water is flowing now, north into any number of forested bottoms, such as Barbershop Canyon or Buck Springs Draw, all feeding East Clear Creek and the Little Colorado, south down the steep face of Mogollon Cliffs and into Horton Creek, Tonto Creek, and the Salt and Gila Rivers. Where the divide and the rim are one, the geography of the divide is rather obvious, but it wasn't always this way. 20 million years ago, today's Jagan Mountains, south of the rim, the Mazatzals, the Sierra Ancha, were high like the Andes and connected to the rim, which wasn't a rim at all, just a lower slope of the Great Ranges. Geologists know this because colorful, smooth stones litter the landscape along today's rim. The rounded red and purple rocks make Forest Road 300 a lumpy, bumpy, cobblestone affair in some places, and they are the same rocks you'll find today in the much-reduced Mazatzals. They came from there so long ago. Back then, the divide would have existed high atop a snowy peak of the ancient mountains south of today's Mogollon Rim. One of my favorite Arizona geology stories involves how our topography has inverted in the last 20 million years, geologist Ringing Rainey says. At that time, water flowed north from central Arizona onto the lowlands of the future Colorado Plateau. In those days, the Little Colorado held a good chunk of geology that now belongs to the Gila. Divides come and go with the weathering of the earth, like the growing wrinkles of our aging skin. In another 20 million years, the Gila will gain more ground as the divide creeps north, following the continued erosion of today's spectacular Mogollon escarpment. And this concludes, There's a Fine Line. Annette McGivney is the author of Sycamore Cabin. With every mile driven southeast on Forest Road 68, Dugas Road, the scenery becomes more remote and beautiful. The buzz of Interstate 17 is replaced by an expansive prairie that eventually transforms into juniper-dotted hills framed by jagged, copper-colored cliffs. Except for the occasional abandoned building, there's nothing but unpeopled wilderness in every direction along this dusty dirt track. But then, a sign for Sycamore Cabin appears at mile 8, and the seemingly impossible becomes a reality. At the end of a short side road sits a fully restored historic house with all the comforts of home, including air conditioning. Listed on the National Register of Historic Places, Sycamore Cabin was built in 1938 by the Civilian Conservation Corps. Before that, the site served as a U.S. Forest Service station for the now-defunct Bloody Basin Ranger District beginning in 1917. The agency upgraded it during the Great Depression to create a comfortable residence for a district ranger and his family. But by the early 1960s, the Forest Service decided to close the ranger outpost due to its isolated location. The home was then used as a base for firefighters, although seasonal crews were also eventually moved to less remote camps. Fortunately for Arizona history buffs, in the early 2000s, the Forest Service decided to restore Sycamore Canyon and add it to its Rooms with a View rental program. We tried to preserve the original CCC architecture and carpentry, says Prescott National Forest Program Manager Tom Palmer. We kept a lot of the original materials. Although the old Forest Service office was torn down, the Depression-era house and barn remain in excellent condition. The wood frame residence has a large living room, a spacious kitchen, and two bedrooms that accommodate up to 6 people. The original wood floors, windows, and kitchen cabinets all hark back to country homes of the 1930s. But the best part is outside, just a stone's throw from the back porch. Sycamore Creek rambles over rocks beneath its towering namesake trees and creates a lush oasis that draws deer, bobcats, and even coyotes. There's no cell service or internet, but the well-worn visitor journal attests to the many ways children have managed to amuse themselves without their phones. They make up stories about a ghost in the basement, roast marshmallows around the fire ring at night, and keep their eyes peeled for a coyote climbing the cliffs above the creek. As for adults, their notes express gratitude for the beautiful scenery, the isolation, and the comforts of heating and air conditioning. But more than anything, visitors staying at Sycamore Canyon appreciate the uninterrupted quality time with family, something that rangers who lived there decades ago surely enjoyed too. Sycamore Cabin is located in Prescott National Forest. Phone number 877-444-6777. Website recreation.gov for reservations. For general information, contact the Verde Ranger District at 928-567-4121. Website fs.usda.gov/Prescott. And this concludes Sycamore Cabin. That concludes today's readings from Arizona Highways. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.